Hi, hello. We truly have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we have four playoff series that we know of. The play-in is going to determine the rest. We talked through the Western Conference playoff series. We talked through the Eastern Conference playoff series, what we like, what we're concerned about, X factors, predictions. You want it, we got it. We then shift to the W side. We react to the WNBA draft, some solid picks, some interesting trades. And then we tap into what this free agency period has been like. What have we liked? What do we have some questions about? We had a lot of fun with this one. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, it's play-in week. It's playoff week. How are we doing?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. We got a lot of hoops to talk about and dive into. It's the best time of the year, so let's get to talking about the game of basketball.
Let's do that. It's a novel concept to talk about the on-court product. But man, we got playoff series locked in. We got play-in matchups. Not going to hang there too long on the play-in matchups. But we got some fascinating series already on lock, and by the time we get to the end of the week, we're going to know the other ones as well. So let's start out in the Western Conference. We have another matchup between the Denver Nuggets and the Minnesota Timberwolves in your 3-6 side of the bracket. On the injury front, keeping an eye on Peyton Watson, suffered a hamstring injury. We're going to see if he's going to be healthy. I think he's going to be very important to Denver's defense, the transition attack, all the things. So hopefully he is there. During the regular season matchups between the two teams, a 3-1 series lead for the Denver Nuggets in this one. Pieces in and out across all four of those games. But starting with what I always like to start with, Steve, with playoff matchups, and particularly this matchup, how are these teams going to guard each other? Because historically, over the last 2-3 years, this has generally been a, we're going to put insert four on Nikola Jokic and let Rudy Gobert roam. Okay, never mind. We're just going to have Rudy Gobert guard Nikola Jokic. Sometimes we're going to double him. Other times we're just going to let Rudy or whoever's guarding him just sit. What does that look like? Jaden McDaniels, you get the Jamal Murray assignment. Sometimes we're picking you up behind half court. Other times we're just letting you get here. Sometimes we're mixing in unders. Other times we're going to ramp up the pressure. I am fascinated by what Minnesota wants to do against this Denver Nuggets offense. I am fascinated as the Denver Nuggets have tried to move Nikola Jokic around the board a little bit. We got some zone. We keep you low on the floor. We'll have you in a drop. We'll still have you up at the level. We'll mix in some late switches. How are the Denver Nuggets going to handle the Minnesota Timberwolves? Because if the regular season matchups give us any key, we are going to move Jokic around the board. We're going to overload one side of the floor against Anthony Edwards and force him to make decisions. We're going to crowd the paint. We're going to muddy the waters for him. I'm fascinated by these defenses, Steve. I think that's where I start with this series. What intrigues you most about Nuggets Wolves?
Well, I think it's a fascinating concept that you have a Minnesota Timberwolves team that has worked to have a level of continuity, but also try to evolve behind what Anthony Edwards brings to the table, behind what they do defensively and try and improve offensively. You have a Denver Nuggets squad under David Adelman that has not necessarily had the fastball you expect from the Denver Nuggets, but they've replaced that with a level of we're comfortable trying different things and being versatile. And we'll throw zone out there, put Jokic on a non. We'll just kind of throw whatever pitch we need to get to the ninth inning and help our team out. And I think it's interesting that there's a familiarity between these teams as they try to evolve. And now they have to face each other once again in the playoffs. And so I think defensively, it's about how they want to guard each other and more about how many attempts do you want to make and what's the first attempt going to be. And so I think there's a world where, hey, Nikola Jokic is guarding Rudy Gobert. I can be in a drop and kind of throw that out there. I can get to the level and put two on the ball. We can go to zone. We can put Jokic on a non-shooter and let him roam. There's different things Denver can do. And I think if you're Minnesota, okay, do we want to put Rudy Gobert on Jokic? Do we know how Nikola Jokic feels about Rudy Gobert? Are we prepared for that? Do we want to put a wing on Jokic? Like, there are just a lot of counter punches each of these teams can throw at each other, especially because of how familiar they are with each other. And that's where I think it gets interesting. And so I think if you're Denver, you're going to have to find a comfort throwing different coverages at Minnesota and Anthony Edwards. It can't just be one thing. because Anthony Edwards mm-hmm. has progressed to a level where if you're giving me one coverage, I know exactly what I have to do. I'm going to get the job done. You have to blend things against him and kind of blindside him to a degree to where it's like you're not necessarily sure if I'm going to trap, if I'm going to be in a drop, if we're going to switch. We have to get you out of rhythm to a degree. The same goes for Nikola Jokic, where honestly, whatever you do, I'm eventually going to get to a point where you do not feel comfortable with how you are guarding me. No matter who's on me, I'm going to score.
Yeah.
You don't want to show a certain amount of help because you know I can pass. Once I score and you now decide I have to show more help, boy, what do we do? Because now
it's cutting we're
at you a different degree, and we got the Nikola Jokic, Aaron Gordon, Jamal Murray, three-man game where you just don't feel good. Like, I think that's the strength of Nikola Jokic and this Denver Nuggets team. We get you in a position mm-hmm. where you do not feel good about what you're doing defensively, and that's their superpower. They have to defend enough to make that count. For Minnesota, it's all about Anthony Edwards being the engine to drive them in this postseason. And so if he's able mm-hmm. to score one-on-one, score in the post, be involved in movement, hit you in pick and roll, and add some playmaking, they become a different team. So I think it's just going to be on the margins, and that's what makes this series so tough.
Mm-hmm. And I think you already kind of touched on the familiarity that both of these teams have against each other. They're going to do different things against each other, but I don't think either side is going to be surprised at any of the attempts. It's very much going to become an execution deal, so I'm excited about that. Going back to the regular season meeting, Steve, because as you talked about, not wanting to feed Anthony Edwards the same look. You don't want to give Nikola Jokic the same look. Jamal Murray has played an all-NBA level pretty much all year long. You look at the regular season matchups and averaged 30-5. Julius Randle, who we haven't talked too much about yet, we're going to get there, 24-6 assists in the regular season meetings. Nikola Jokic averaged 36-15-11 against the Minnesota Timberwolves this season. First player in NBA history to average at least 35-15-10 against a singular opponent at minimum 4 games. That's not what that's supposed to look like. And you look at some of the Jokic buckets during the regular season matchups, especially with Rudy Gobert on them. Like, these are, I'm trying to push out your catch. Like, I'm mirroring you in space when necessary. I'm contesting these. It just has not mattered. And that's where I think the real inflection point is going to be. Like, how do you deal with Jokic to score, I think, from Minnesota's side? I think as we've talked about this series and these matchups before over the course of the podcast history, Steve, I think you've largely indexed on you got to make Jamal Murray uncomfortable. And I do agree with you there. If Nikola Jokic is doing all of this, it naturally makes life easier for Jamal Murray because you just don't have an answer for your number one guy. And so I am just kind of curious to see like how much they're actually willing to live with when it comes to Jokic getting one-on-one coverage, especially when it is Rudy Gobert, because he is their best option. And if Jokic is torching your top option to this degree, it does force you into even more uncomfortable decisions. Like, that feels like it could get hazy very quickly for a Minnesota Timberwolves defense that is statistically good, but has been kind of searching for a level of consistency all year long. And so I'm curious to see, like, what the playoff version of this defense is going to look like.
Well, you got to jump in. Throw the regular season thoughts out with the bathwater. The playoffs are different defensively. Because you are focused on one team and you are trying to do certain things. So mm-hmm. the regular season is, to me, how many things can we do? What do we do very well in a playoff series? I said last year with the Pacers, you have the ability to game plan for a specific team. And everyone can be on board with what we're doing for this specific team. And we can execute our switch and doubles. We can go ahead and put Rudy as a roamer. Like, we can do different things, but we're locked in on that. So I wouldn't necessarily copy and paste what a team has done in the regular season to what they'll do playoff-wise. Take the regular season as what they could do, potentially, and realize that they could execute that at a high level in the playoffs. I don't know exactly what Minnesota's going to try and do. I know both teams will try different pitches, but I think the toughest part about Denver, right, Nikias, is that, again, Nikola Jokic will put you in a position where, okay, it's fine that you've decided to do this as a defense. I'm going to make this uncomfortable for you. And so, okay, Rudy mm-hmm. Gobert, let's have a dance. I'll score. I'll attack. ooh, how good do we feel about this? Okay, we're switching pick and rolls. If I screen, I may attack. I may just get the ball and see if you'll help and make a play. That's the interplay in this series between these two teams. And so I'm intrigued to see how much they want to double Anthony Edwards. And do they want to put themselves in position? Because in the regular season, you know, part of the fun of Anthony Edwards was, hey, I can cook on ball, one-on-one, do what I do. I can go and pick and roll. And if you want to trap me, I'm making the reads. I'm making the right plays. I can add these post-ups. What do you want to do? We've seen Denver put Nikola Jokic and say, hey, go run at him. Take that off the board. And now, yeah, it's fine. We know you can do a lot of things, but posting up is not going to be one of them. So what are you going to do now? That's where it gets fun as far as, okay, how many things can Denver just say, absolutely not, Anthony Edwards, you're not doing this. How many things can Minnesota say, hey, Nikola Jokic, we don't want you to do. How many answers could you deliver back to the Wolves as far as doesn't matter, we're going to cook. It's a fascinating series. Again, like they are trying to evolve, both teams, and they are now faced against each other in a steel cage once again.
I love this. I have a couple of free throws for you while we're here. One, because we're going to get to like actual X-Factor picks a little bit later to close out this series, but who's more important for Minnesota in this series, in your opinion? Julius Randle or Jaden McDaniels? They're going to need both, but who do you think needs to have a loud performance of the two?
Julius Randle. I think it's Julius Randle for me. I think at the worst, you know Jaden McDaniels is going to do his job defensively, and he wants to have a time with Jamal Murray. We'll put it that way. I think you need the best version of Julius Randle as far as being quick, decisive, locked in defensively, someone who can make a defense pay, especially if he's dealing with Aaron Gordon at times, if he's dealing with Jokic at times, if he's playing with Naz Reid, depending on what they do. But you need the best version of Julius Randle for this team to have success. And so that's not a shout. Like that's not a shot at Jaden McDaniels. It's more so I understand what Julius Randle could do. They need that to get out of this series.
No, I think that's fair. Like, you have the drives, the post-up blends, the playmaking they can have out of those drives or post-ups. And if Minnesota dabbles in any sort of cross-matching to let Rudy Gobert roam, Randle's going to have to soak up some possessions against Jokic, which that's not a fun job to sign up for. But he may just have to do that in spots during the series. So, like, I like the selection. I was stuck because my initial thought was I'm with you. Like, you just kind of need Julius Randle to set the table. Maybe outplay Jamal Murray if you're just looking at the star matchups. I might lean Jaden McDaniels in this one. Like, defending Jamal Murray is not an easy one. He averaged 20 against Denver during the regular season. And overall, like, he just had more on-ball responsibility this year. They're going to need that secondary creation from him as well. And so any minutes in which Ant's not on the floor, or if it is a situation where Denver is continuing to ramp things up against Ant in pick and roll, where they blitzed him on nearly 18% of his pick and rolls during the regular season matchups, they have those overloads where, as you mentioned, Jokic is going to run at them. They're going to need Jaden McDaniels to make more plays than anticipated, or more plays than you would usually expect from him. That two-way kind of impact that he could have on this series, like, that's kind of where I lean him, but I want to get your thoughts on that. The other question that I had for you was, whose bench do you trust heading into the series?
Can I hit you with the reverse card? It's the green one, by the way. But does it matter? It's the playoffs. And so every series you're in is a different series for whoever's on your bench. And so you may have a series where player X is now very important for us. It might be a Tim Hardaway Jr. series, right? It doesn't mean that Tim Hardaway Jr. is going to copy and paste it every series, but depending on how a defense is playing, or depending on what you're running offensively, you may have someone rise to the occasion. I think for me, the important part for both teams is the fact that they have leaned into and experimented with different lineups and put themselves in position to throw different things out there in the playoffs. So whose bench do I trust more? Denver has the veterans, but does this become a, ooh, do we need Jonas series? Ooh, are we going with Aaron Gordon at the five when Jokic is not out? Mm-hmm. If you're Minnesota, how deep are we going? what's the non-Rudy minutes look like? Is it Nas Reed and Julius Randle? Is it just Nas? Like, I think there's some tweaks on both sides that make it difficult to say exactly whose bench do I trust. I'd probably lean Denver because I think they have more pitches as far as that goes with their bench and what they can do. But that also comes with the non-Jokic minutes are shrinking because it's the playoffs. So am I trusting their bench or am I trusting the fact that they can go small, they can go with Jonas, or they can go with Jokic? I don't know where I'm at with that, but I probably go Denver. What say you?
Okay. Like I probably lean Minnesota, or at least I want to lean Minnesota, because when you have Nas, when you have Ayo Dosunmu, who I think is going to loom pretty large in this series as well, I'm sure he's going to spend some time on Jamal Murray as well, might even close out some games for them, depending on just what the lineup synergy looks like, what some potential foul trouble may look like in the perimeter room. We'll see. I want to go Minnesota. I do agree with you that Denver has a little bit more that they can toss out. They just have so many high variance options, though, is where I'm curious. Like, I think Bruce Brown's going to be a very important piece in this series. Tim Hardaway Jr. shot darn near 60% from three on high volume against Minnesota during the regular season matchups. I don't think that holds, but like his shooting and his shot making in general has been pretty important overall. I'll lean Minnesota. I think in general, I want to trust Minnesota. I'm kind of scarred by what the Minnesota experience has been so far this year. But I think I'll lean Minnesota. So to close this out, Steve, who are your X factors in this series? And then we'll get to your prediction after that.
No, you tell me your X factors, buddy.
Fair enough. Well, I'm going to the defenders. I start with Jaden McDaniels for the reasons I mentioned a little bit earlier. They're going to need the secondary scoring, may need some playmaking. If they do downsize in the non-Rudy Gobert minutes, something that you've talked about is this funky zone with Jaden McDaniels in the middle. I think in general, how often Minnesota can force turnovers against this Denver offense that has been elite all year long is going to be a very important subplot of the series. Jaden McDaniels is going to play a pretty big role in that. He obviously is going to have the Murray assignment. He's my X factor for Minnesota. For Denver, it's Christian Brown. Mm-hmm. Like, he's going to get the Ann assignment out soon. I would assume he gets the Ann assignment. I'm also just looking at, not that it's a new gambit in his career or anything like that, but like some of these late season matchups where teams are like, oh, that's Christian Brown, the 3-point line. We don't really do what you want, big dog. I appreciate that he has shot with volume in some of those instances, but I think for however often Minnesota wants to dial up, we are double teaming Nikola Jokic. It is going to be made easier if Christian Brown is not shooting well from three or turning down shots from three. And so, like, that's going to be important. In addition to, he's going to spend some time on Anthony Edwards. So those are probably the two guys that I highlight the most. Though, as you kind of alluded to, there are a lot of characters that could swing this series.
I'm going Tim Hardaway Jr. for Denver. I think that his fit with Denver and the fact that he can make a ton of shots, they don't necessarily need him to a degree, is the perfect context. And so if he starts cooking, I think that adds a different element for Denver. For the Minnesota Timberwolves, I probably go Ayo Dosunmu. I think Ayo is the X factor for Minnesota as far as what he can do on both ends. They brought him to this team for a reason. Offensively, we've seen what he can do in transition, what he can do off ball, what he can do when he's involved in pick and roll and secondary actions. I think he gives them a level of lineup versatility. And so I wanted to go Dante, but I think it's Ayo Dosunmu as far as if he is able to have an 8 or 9 out of 10 a series, Minnesota becomes a different team to deal with. And so I think those are my X-factors.
Okay, that's fair. All right, before we move to Lakers-Rockets, Steve, who do you have in this series?
Oh, I have to do the tradition. Chris Finch said they'll be oiled up. Wolves in six.
Oil up is insane. Okay. Well, I have the Nuggets in six. Plan to close in six. Would not rule out Minnesota in this one. Again, back-to-back Western Conference Finals appearances for them. So a deep playoff run, not out of the cards. Have a little bit more faith in Denver, and particularly the top three and how they're used together. So there we go. We now move to the 4-5 in the Western Conference, Steve. We've got Kevin Durant. We've got LeBron James. We don't know how many of the co-stars LeBron James will have with him. We are keeping eyes on Luka Doncic with the hamstring injury. Austin Reeves seems to be more firmly out as he deals with the oblique injury. So I would be surprised if we see either in round one, but Luka's been overseas. He's certainly trying to expedite the process to come back. So we'll see what happens there. But we do have LeBron James and Kevin Durant, which One, it's just kind of insane that they are still playing at this level, this late into their careers, and we are getting yet another playoff duel between these two. So, like, that is just cool, first and foremost. But as we dig into this series, like, I do kind of start with LeBron, as he is going to be trekking along without Luka and Austin Reeves, at least in the immediate short term. And it's a similar question that I asked you a couple weeks ago. We were just talking through the Western Conference. Like, hey, what is this ramp up going to look like for LeBron James? The early returns we're looking at these last four or five games has been, yeah, I can still just be LeBron. I can give you a 30 and 15, a 28 and 14, whatever you need. Can still drive, can still post up, can still play make, all the things. And now that we hit this playoff situation, you worry about LeBron's workload during the regular season because you want to get him to this point. Now that we're at this point, I'm just fascinated by what the full LeBron ramp up is going to look like for an entire playoff round and how Houston plans on dealing with that. Because they have a lot of different options to throw at LeBron, but all of them pose different things that LeBron can poke at.
I don't know if it's a ramp up to a degree. This probably, if we're being honest, this year where we people who talked about basketball called LeBron a supercharged role player, LeBron said, I'll do that for now because he's still LeBron James. And so the efficiency and the effort that he's displayed once everyone left out was a reminder, which is insane because of how long he's played the game, but a reminder of, hey, I'm still really good at this, folks. Mm-hmm. And the whole vision was, hey, can we be a good enough team where I don't have to do this the entire season? And the Laker run was mostly like, haha, no, we're going to try, but no. It's like, fine, I'll take all this pick and roll and post up reps and I'll be the pressure point. And this year he didn't have to be. That doesn't mean he's not a pressure point. I think people have to remember that. He's still LeBron James. And so once everyone went out, you feel a different way about the Lakers, but the Lakers can now play the hits. Hey, LeBron, here's a post touch. We will see how the defense wants to guard you. Use your mind for the game to see if there's a baseline or a double from one pass away. Let's see what happens. The interesting part about this series is what does Houston want to do with LeBron, considering he's the number one option without Luka or Austin Reeves? Do they want to send a double, or do they trust the size and length that they have to defend, contain, contest? We're not giving you extra plays. So I think that's where it gets interesting. Can LeBron force the Rockets to put two on the ball and now open things up for the Lakers offensively? Because that's been the biggest thing. LeBron has been able to make the right reads and make the right plays. For Houston, they also are facing the same issue. And this is a Lakers team that is not afraid to switch, is not afraid to show early help, is not afraid to rotate and recover. So are they going to give Kevin Durant two on the ball? Because the secret of the Rockets, right? Everyone wants to complain about different things. That's fine. But when the Rockets have Kevin Durant, like the stretch they had where they won 9 of the last 10 games, just locked into 5 because the Western Conference isn't fair. But it was just Kevin Durant makes a whole bunch of shots in the first quarter. Defense says, this is not great. Let's put not two you. On the ball. And now it's like, haha, Alperen Şengün, would you like to set a screen for me? And then the Rockets rediscover ball movement. It's a different vibe when Kevin Durant is able to set the table. Will the Lakers give him that? Will they give him two on the ball? Or will they say, we're going to switch, we're going to contain, you got to make buckets, but we're not going to budge from it. And now we feel like we can take away Alperen Şengün with different matchups because they got Marcus Smart, who has and will guard anyone. But can we take Alperen Şengün away? Can we help off Amen Thompson? Can we help off Tari Eason? Like, can we, Jabari Smith, make a play? The game plan specifics from the Lakers is where I get fascinated, because if they live in a world where we're not giving Kevin Durant two on the ball, not that Kevin Durant can't make them pay, but we're not going to give you that. Like, that's not going to be on the table. There's not going to be a trap. There's not going to be doubles. Like, you got to make it work. Does that bog the Rockets down? And how do they handle that? Like, I know everyone's saying, ooh, Rockets and whatever, but if I had a Lakers polo on, okay, how do we make Kevin Durant the best player in the series and take away everyone else?
No, I think that's a fair counterpoint. And like to the aggression point overall, because I think you nailed it. How often do you want to put two on the ball against LeBron? What does that open up? How often do you want to put two on the ball against Kevin Durant or Alperen Şengün for that matter? And how much does that open up? Like going through as much as you can with these regular season matchups, again, with Luke and Austin Reeves out, it just makes it an entirely different series. But like broader strokes, this has largely been like a possession regular season matchup between these two. Mm-hmm. When the Houston Rockets beat you up on the offensive glass and take care of the ball, they win. We get the Christmas Day matchup. When the Houston Rockets can beat you up on the offensive glass, but it isn't as prevalent, and the Lakers turn them over, the Lakers win. When you all, and you also had Luka Doncic losing his mind for a week, longer than a week, of course, but like for that stretch, of, you know, they played twice in 3 days or whatever it was. And it's like, okay, well, this is how the Lakers can get kind of busy. So like, I'm curious to see what that balance is going to be like. Is this going to be more of a switch and early help series for the Lakers versus we are putting two on you? Less because we don't want to open things up, but more because maybe this is our way to get some easy baskets in transition if we can turn you over. Because the Rockets have been a pretty high turnover team pretty much all year long. And even circling back to the LeBron portion and some of the mismatch hunting they can get into, if we're playing the hits with LeBron James, that gets me back to square one with the Houston Rockets, in which question becomes, okay, one, who are you starting? Because we've gotten Reed Shepherd in the starting lineup, and then it's like, well, actually, let's start Tari Eason. Well, actually, let's start Josh Okogie. All right, let's bring Reed back, et cetera. How does Reed factor into this series? He's obviously going to play a role. Do you start him to try to further grease the wheels of the offense, maybe limit some of the turnover stuff? Does that give the Lakers something to poke at if you were trying to switch and flat things out? Because it is easy to say,
pause,
we're not letting
pause.
You get... Oh, go ahead.
Stop. Hold on. Yes. If you start Reed Shepherd, LeBron James, do we not know what LeBron James has done? Attacking matchups? LeBron's going to be like, that's hey, Reed Shepherd, would you like to guard me? Is this show and recover? Is this how we get a role open? Like, I don't know if I would immediately start Reed Shepherd. Not that Reed Shepherd has failed defensively this year. It's more so just like, don't give the Lakers and LeBron and JJ a target where they can be like, yep, that's how we're opening things up. And now, if you poke at Reed Shepherd enough early in the series, they're going to pivot, right? So yeah. Now you don't want to take one of your players off the board. So that's where it's like, I think Reed Shepherd's in a good place. I think he's grown, but I think you allow him to come off the bench and you let him close, but know that LeBron's probably going to want to put him in action because that's what he does.
That is indeed what he does. To that point, the Rockets minus 29 in 78 minutes with Reed on the floor during the Lakers during the regular season matchup. So just keeping an eye on that. In terms of being put in action, the pick and roll stuff is actually like Mart is relatively fine, slightly below average. If you're looking at what the per possession numbers were when he's defending the ball versus when he's being put in action as a screener. So we'll see what that balance is going to be, but I am fascinated by that portion. Steve, who are your X factors in the series?
Well, before we get into X factors, I think the most important player for Houston, like Kevin Durant, they need him to be great. You probably expect that, right? They need an Alperen Şengün series to get past the Lakers. I think if you're pushing all your chips in on Houston winning this series easily, you're assuming Alperen Şengün is game on both ends of the floor. He's got to be able to play the right way, be willing to move the ball, make the right reads, attack matchups when you get it, not tween hezzy from the three-point line. Like, I think if Şengün is locked in, that's where the Rockets will elevate to a degree. Because when he plays at a high level, it's a different thing. And we saw that earlier in the season. We've seen it at different points at the end of the season. When Şengün is playing with a confidence and a pace and a tempo and I'm catching the ball at the elbow, not three-point line, now he's a capper to what they're doing in the half court on top of what Kevin Durant does. That's what they need to a degree. So I think he's probably the second most important person in this series. My X factor is for the Lakers is Marcus Smart. They need a massive Marcus Smart series as far as being able to defend everyone on the Houston Rockets, no matter what, being able to cover any sort of gaps defensively and help, and then bringing a blend of playmaking and shot making on the offensive end. So I think Marcus Smart is probably the X factor for me for the Lakers. For the Rockets, I would probably go Tari Eason. Which version of Tari Eason would you get? Is he going to be able to be locked in defensively, defend multiple positions? Will he knock down shots, mix in some drives? When Tari Eason plays at a high level, and this is the thing I've said about Houston, right? Everyone wanted to have a conversation about Reed Shepherd, right? But you need Reed Shepherd and Amen Thompson to be good at the same time. That's the whole point. Mm-hmm. The ultimate goal is for all of these guys to be good at the same time. And that includes Tari Eason, not just Jabari, right? You need Tari Eason to play at a certain level to make this work to where we now have lineup versatility that we want to throw out there as opposed to we are reacting to what you're doing. So if he's able to be active defensively, he's able to attack in transition, if he's able to drive in the half court, mix in some makes in the three-point line, I think that helps the Rockets push forward in this playoff series.
Okay. I like it. I just, as you mentioned, Amen Thompson towards the end there, I just want, he's not my X factor for this series, but I just wanted to highlight, one, he is very good. He is very important for what Houston wants to do on both ends of the floor. He has been very good in the calendar year 2026. He was the Rockets' leading scorer in their matchups against the Lakers overall this year. Averaged 24 on insane efficiency. Who he guards is fascinating to me. Like, I don't think he gets LeBron outright. I think they're going to want to unlock him off the ball, just kind of muck things up. Curious to see what the transition attacks and things look like for him. But I just want to make sure I mention Amen Thompson at the very least. He's going to loom very large in this series on both ends of the floor. In terms of my X factors in this one, it's Reed Shepherd on the Houston side for me. For the reasons, what is the playmaking / shot making blend going to look like? How well does he hold up defensively? And even if he holds up defensively individually, does Houston shifting more attention to make sure he doesn't get blasted open things up elsewhere? And so, like, just fit, you know, what the two-way bounce for Reed is going to be in this series is going to be important. And for the Lakers, I was kind of torn because I thought Marcus Smart, so I'm glad that you got Marcus Smart there. I was like, is it going to be Luke Kennard? They're going to need him to do more. Is it going to be like Jake LaRavia? Because I'm sure he's also going to spend some time on KD in this one. I ultimately landed on Rui Hachimura. I assume he's in the starting lineup. I assume he gets some early KD looks between him and Marcus Smart. They are going to need a real two-way impact series from Rui Hachimura. And on top of that, they're going to need him to grab some boards. They're going to need him to put some bodies on folks in this one. And Houston, even without Steven Adams, they've gone from we are the best offensive rebounding team of all time to we are the best offensive rebounding team in the league, which is still good. You don't want to render your stops in vain. You don't want to force misses and then give them up. And I imagine if we're getting a lot of Rui at the four, him plus DeAndre Ayton, they're going to have to clean the glass in this one. No pun intended. The Rockets had a 44.1 offensive rebound rate against the Lakers during the regular season matchups. Like, they have to get that down. Rui's going to have to be a part of that. And again, knock down the open threes, beat tilted defenses with some attacks, and maybe get some offensive rebounds for himself. But, like, I'm keeping an eye on what Rui looks like in this series. Steve, who do you have winning this one ultimately?
The Lakers have something up their sleeve, and they have built habits. And I think they're a very good team, well-coached. LeBron James is going to be on a mission. Everyone's going to feel like this is a series that's a layup right now. I would hesitate against that. And I might be wrong. There's nothing wrong with being wrong in life. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go Rockets in six, but I think it's going to be a hard six. And I think both of these fan bases are going to exchange being unbelievably upset over the course of the next 2 weeks.
This is guaranteed to be the series in which nobody is happy late in fourth quarters. That's all. That's the firmest prediction that I have. We're going to get a game where the Rockets are like, what the heck are y'all doing in clutch time? And we're going to get a game where it's like, LeBron does not have the ball. What are y'all doing? Or can y'all please get a stop? It is just going to happen in this series. I have the Rockets in five. Like, I do think they just have so many more pathways against a Lakers team that is just missing their best and their second or third best player. And I am really worried about what the Lakers look like in the time that LeBron has to go to the bench. And that's where I was also just kind of like, what is the LeBron workload going to look like? Not just what his touch is going to look like. Is this going to be a series in which LeBron has to average 40 or 41 minutes a game to compensate for them and stuff? If it's closer to 36, 38, he can still have a high impact. But we've seen plenty of series in the league where a star player plays 38, they win those minutes, they get blasted by so much in the other ones that it renders it mute. I feel like it's going to be one of those. I agree this is going to be a tightly contested series. I think the Rockets ultimately win this one in five because when LeBron sits, I don't know where the offense is going to come from consistently enough. But we're going to take a break there. And when we return, we shift to the Eastern Conference, a pair of fascinating series in the East. Stay tuned. We're going to rock it out. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the Eastern Conference with the series that we know as of now. And funny enough, we're going to start with a series that we may not know too much about. We have Cavs-Raptors in the 4-5. Keeping an eye on Emmanuel quickly. So dealing with a hamstring strain listed as day-to-day. So we'll see if he's fully healthy, ready to go. He's going to limit the minutes, but we'll see. Just keep an eye on that portion. So during the regular season matchup, Steve, the good news is for the Toronto Raptors, they swept the Cleveland Cavaliers, won all three matchups. The bad news in terms of projecting what that actually means is that these matchups happened on Halloween, November 13th, and November 24th. All three matchups happened not before 2026, not before Christmas. They all happened before Thanksgiving, in which you go through those game logs and we see some Naquan Tomlin. We see starter Lonzo Ball. It's a, you know, and so naturally this is also pre-James Harden trade. There's just a lot of noise in between what these regular season matchups are. So, like, that leads to a level of intrigue for me on the other side of this, where it's like, oh, this is going to be the first time that these versions of these teams have faced each other for real. And I'm excited to see what that looks like. We naturally have, like, the draft narrative bit where you have Scottie Barnes and Evan Mobley, and they have matched up quite a bit against each other across these matchups and just in their NBA careers. So, like, that part's going to be fun. But in a similar place to the Wolves-Nugget series, I also start with on both sides. How are they going to guard each other? What does this look like? With Evan Mobley, is he going to have the Scottie Barnes assignment? Or do you find another non-shooter or something to keep him closer to the paint, to wall off the paint for the Toronto Raptors? Where their bugaboo in the half court has been, wait, can we actually access the paint in a way that opens up open shots elsewhere? Can we consistently get all the way down here and impose our will in the half court? If you deploy Evan Mobley in a specific way, maybe that makes that more difficult. Scottie Barnes, as we know, will defend a little bit of everyone. We've seen him on Donovan Mitchell during these regular season matchups. In general, he's defended guards. He spent a lot of time on Evan Mobley. Where are you placing him in this matchup? What are you trying to take away? What are you ultimately looking to live with in that scenario? I kind of start with the defense on both sides here, Steve. Well, what intrigues you about this matchup?
Well, I mean, I think you nailed it as far as we don't know a lot about what these teams are going to do each other. We're going to learn very quickly because the Cleveland Cavaliers have added James Harden, who makes a difference. And the Toronto Raptors are looking at this in a scenario where it's like, hey, we might be able to do something defensively to bring you into the mud. I think the question is, what lineups does Toronto want to go with? How much do we want to lean into switching, whether it's a small ball lineup with CMB at the five, whether it's Jakob Poeltl switching occasionally? Are we giving Cleveland two on the ball? Who are we giving Cleveland two on the ball against? Is it just Donovan? Is it Donovan and James? Can we trust the Toronto Raptors to rotate consistently? Cleveland has the answers when they can get you in rotation. The question is, when are you going to do that? And so I think it's a balancing act if you're Toronto, as far as I think in their back pocket, we can have some lineups that will switch, bog you down. We have size, we have length, you won't have fun. If I'm Cleveland, I have Donovan Mitchell, I have James Harden, I have two bigs that can operate in different positions, play together and also play separately. And so how committed are you to that? On one hand, the switching kind of takes away an element of Evan Mobley rolling, Jared Allen rolling. And now, okay, what are you going to do? We switched. You're going to stand in the dunker spot? Are you going to space? Like, what are you going to do? Is that where Toronto lands ultimately? If you're Cleveland, you're going to have to find a pressure point, find a way to get Toronto to put two on the ball, whether it's a switch and double scenario or it's two on the ball and pick and roll because Donovan Mitchell has decided to dribble and put the ball over someone's head 17 times. I think it gets interesting. If you're Cleveland on the other end, okay, this is a Toronto team that is based on Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram offensively to a degree. RJ Barrett, tremendous connective piece. I mean, it quickly can elevate them when he's cooking, but we have to kind of poke at these two players. We have to make Scottie Barnes into a player that's not as aggressive, and we got to make things tough on Brandon Ingram. If we can do those two things, you probably feel good about your prospects in this series. So there's a lot that's hanging in the balance. And so the intrigue is fun as far as trying to find a theory as to who does what and when. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, like I think you really hit on something with the switching overall. I kind of want to hang there for a little bit because I think Cleveland at their best, either pre-Harden trade or since the Harden trade in particular, when they are able to just flow from action to action to action, we get downhill, we spray it out, we attack, they're in flow state, you're not going to have fun against this Cleveland Cavaliers offense with the various options you could put alongside their core four. Toronto, when they are able to get stops or force turnovers, you now have Scottie Barnes either grabbing and going, getting downhill or getting into some of those early seals, or you just have Brandon Ingram now attacking early in the clock. You have Emmanuel Quickley that just kind of jitterbug all over the place. RJ Barrett attacking you and putting his shoulder into your chest. They're a difficult team to deal with. You switch against either of those teams in the half court, though. It's not that they can't have success. We know what kind of shot making Brandon Ingram can get into. We know what kind of shot making Donovan Mitchell can get into. All of the off the dribble threes that James Harden can tap into. Some of the growth that we've seen from Jared Allen and Evan Mobley, particularly in, you know, since February onward. They have both played incredibly well. It can turn into a, ooh, this series is being played a lot more slowly than either team really wants to right now. And I'm fascinated to see what it looks like in those moments. Because I think if Toronto does land on Scottie, you have Donovan Mitchell. James, we're going to switch against you. We're going to trust that we can contest these step back threes. And if you make them, we got to tip our cap. Or if you get downhill, you're doing so against a whole bunch of our length. We're okay with dealing with that. If that's the bit, if you mix in switching on top of that, that puts more of a spotlight on those bigs. Are you ready to win those matchups? As we talked about with the chase down guys, if you do have some size mismatches after switches, like what kind of offensive rebounding are we seeing? Because if Cleveland can get busy there, that puts Toronto in a bit of a perilous spot. And if they can't, you're now feeding Toronto transition baskets and they don't have to worry about some of the half-court woes you can get them into. So, like, that's going to be a really fun back and forth for me. And even if you mentioned Brandon Ingram, and I've talked a little bit about him, that brings me back to a central question that I've had with the Cavaliers. Last week, on the Chase Down pod, et cetera, who is the fifth for Cleveland? Is it going to be Dean Wade? And if it is, okay, cool. We are putting Dean Wade on Brandon Ingram. We can put Evan Mobley on Scottie Barnes or have some elsewhere and we can roll them around. Like, what does that do? Are we now able to put y'all further in the mud offensively? And now it doesn't matter how good your half-court defense is because you're just kind of in scramble mode when we're forcing misses for you on the other end. Like, that part is super fascinating to me. And, like, a question I want to pose to you, Steve, similar to the Minnesota-Denver bit, is how do you feel about these second units heading in? Because I think Cleveland overall probably has more options. It has a level of stability to them. But, like, I feel like their core bench pieces are smaller, and I wonder if that also unlocks a level of mismatch hunting that Toronto can tap into, and maybe that alleviates some of the half-court concerns you may have for them.
I mean, I think it could. I think the difference is, if you're Cleveland, your concern would probably be, do we tinker too much with our lineups versus do we have options? I think the strength of Cleveland this season is we have optionality, we have versatility in our team and in our lineup to put ourselves in a different position to where we can operate in a different level. If I'm Toronto, you're needing certain players to do certain things, and how many do you trust to do that in those moments? And so I would lean towards Cleveland's bench. I think the biggest thing for me, if I'm Cleveland, I need everyone to operate at a high level. I need to be able to shuffle the deck, but shuffle the deck from a position of strength. And so, you know, I don't want to lean too much early to my X-Factor pick, but Sam Merrill, when he is able to defend, which he gives the effort, I'm not afraid of anything. I'll be on ball, off ball, whatever you need me to do, and I can operate and open things up for us offensively. But if we can kind of have a shuffling of the deck where Dean Wade's effective, Max Strus is effective, Sam Merrill's effective, we have the terror twins of Keon Ellis and Dennis Schroeder. So we can kind of mix things up to a different degree. That's the biggest thing for Cleveland, is just finding a way to understand what lineups you want to do because it suits you and not be reactive in this playoff series. And so it's the pressure's on Toronto to make them reactive to a degree. Brandon Ingram has to do X amount of things offensively to make Cleveland blink to a degree. Scottie Barnes, intrigued to see what happens in a playoff context for him. Not because I don't believe in the player, more so I don't know how defenses are going to treat him. As far as, hey, Scottie Barnes, you're great. Here's an under. here's a switch. We're not showing help. Get a basket. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't, okay, we feel good about how we're guarding Scotty Barnes. Brandon, we're going to make it tough on you. Are you making enough shots to make us double? If you're not, IQ, RJ, it's on y'all to raise the level of the wave of the ship. That's where Cleveland kind of has to operate in this series.
Yeah. Like, I think just to quickly bounce off of that, 20-10-6 for Scotty against Cleveland this year. But again, all those matchups happen before Thanksgiving, so we'll see if anything changes on that front. But Scotty really has an opportunity to dictate terms on both ends of this series. Like, I've talked a little bit about the defensive matchups already, but even offensively, I think Cleveland is going to be willing to switch against them, especially if they start Dean Wade, because they will probably tap into a level of cross matching on top of that. I think Scotty can really dictate terms as a driver and as a post threat in this series. And if he does, make Cleveland blink with some, if it's just showing a little bit early help or if it's just a flat out double team, that could be enough to kind of loosen the shackles of this half court offense and give Toronto a little bit more wiggle room. And while circling back, like, I probably agree with you, I probably trust Cleveland's bench a little bit more. There is a level of variance with this Toronto bench that would scare me a little bit if I'm Cleveland, if I don't have my ducks in a row. Okay. Like, it kind of circles into some of my X Factor stuff. Like, I didn't ultimately pick Jakob Poeltl as my Toronto X Factor, but he's very high up on the list. If Cleveland renders him like, oh, actually, you're just not going to have a good time, that is a win in a sense, but that does mean more CMB, and him plus Scotty defensively has been nasty pretty much all year long, complimentary. This could indeed end up being a Mamu series. Which, hey, if you have the blend of the shot making and some of the handoff flow that you can get into and just some of just the early chaos you can get into if Toronto's forcing stops, that gets kind of fun for me. Into my actual Toronto X Factor. Hey, man, what are we getting from Jamal Shedd in this series? Because we're talking about, like, who's defending these guards. I think Jamal Shedd is going to have his turn against James Harden. I think Jamal Shedd is going to have his turn against Donovan Mitchell. That gets intriguing for me. And I think in terms of, can we access the paint? Can we generate advantages? Jamal Shedd remains a walking paint touch for Toronto when he's on the floor. And if we're in a situation where Emmanuel Quickley is a little bit compromised with the hamstring, or maybe he misses game one or whatever the case may be, they're just going to need big two-way production from him anyway. And so, like, would not surprise me at all if we get into this series, it's like, okay, well, Cleveland starters are beating Toronto starters. Here comes Shedd. Here comes Mamu. Here comes Jacoby Walter. And now it's like, wait, they're forcing a bunch of turnovers. Here's some early offense flow. Here's some timely shot making. All of a sudden, their bench is just handily beating Cleveland's. And now we got ourselves a series. So, like, I'm fascinated to see what that dynamic overall is going to look like, Steve. So I've mentioned Jamal Shedd as my Toronto X Factor. Before I move to the Cleveland portion, Steve, who are your X Factors in this one?
Sam Merrill for Cleveland. I think when he's playing at a high level, he elevates them to a degree, and especially with Max Strus being back, they just have an optionality, and he can open the playbook. I think they're willing to switch among different players. He's been active defensively. So for me, it's Sam Merrill, because that's hard to deal with when he's making shots and they have movement, and they have flow. So we talked about, hey, can they get two on the ball? When he's in action, it gets tough. So Sam Merrill, to me, is really important for Cleveland to get a win in this series. For Toronto, he's probably graduated from this class, but I'm going RJ Barrett, to me.
Okay.
If Toronto gets the best version of RJ Barrett, that's a different series to me. Because, yeah, Brandon Ingram can make you pay. Yeah, you're trying to contain Scotty Barnes, but if RJ Barrett's able to find the gaps and be in the in-between and drive in transition, if he's able to drive off a second side action, that becomes interesting. And so every time when you get to a playoff series, you're always game planning the top players and trying to take something away from them. But if someone else emerges, it's just like, okay, we had a budget and we are spending X amount of money. I don't have the money for my car breaking down right now.
Mm-hmm.
Every series has someone who makes you make that decision. And so if RJ Barrett comes in and he cooks a certain level, you can make this same part of Emmanuel Quickley. If the Raptors can get a quote-unquote third that can make Cleveland pay consistently, now Cleveland has to think in a different manner, a different way. So I think that's where I lean. That's where they need the greatest version of RJ Barrett if they want to get to the second round.
No, I think that's fair. Like, I think if it's a situation to where you are putting, let's say they Cleveland does start Dean Wade. If you have Mobley on Scottie Barnes, and let's say we got Dean Wade on Brandon Ingram going to chase you around. It's like, well, what are we, who's defending RJ Barrett at that point? Is that Donovan Mitchell? And is that just a size advantage that RJ can get downhill against? Donovan Mitchell's strong in his own right, but like, is that something you can kind of poke at? Maybe you get some early foul trouble. Now it's like more creation duty shift to James Harden. Like, I love the RJ Barrett shout for you. Mentioned Jamal Shedd already. It's two way, he could have a real two-way impact on this series. Dean Wade's the other guy. Whether he starts or not, he can unlock some of the switching and cross-match over Cleveland. The shot making is going to be important because if he's not making or taking shots, turning some of those down, that unlocks a level of cross-match for Toronto, I would imagine, matchup-wise. You don't want to feed them more things to bring Cleveland's offense into the mud because that transition attack can get fun. Steve, who do you have in this one?
I'm going to go Cavs in five. Cleveland in five.
Cavs?
That's what I'm going with.
Okay. I am going to go Cleveland in six. I think I do still trust their offense overall a little bit more than Toronto's as we get into the setting. But I really do think the second unit battle is going to loom pretty large in this series. I'm fascinated to see how many of those games swing there. As we move to the 3-6, Steve, we have Knicks. We have Hawks. We just talked about them last week. Very excited about that matchup. It'll be the first time that those two teams have faced off with this iteration of their teams and things. And so if you want to go back and check out all our thoughts there, you can. But we do have the regular season matchup. They, again, played on April the 6th. The Knicks with a 108-105 win in that particular game. And so for me, base questions heading into this series remains. For New York, can you get and keep Karl-Anthony Towns involved? And tied to that for the Atlanta Hawks, one of the things that popped for me very early on was, oh, they're just defending the Knicks straight up. This is just Onyeka, Kongu, and Karl-Anthony Towns. Are they going to tap into a level of cross-matching? Is that a card that they were kind of holding for a potential playoff series? This is why I wanted to ask you during that stream that we did after that game. It's like, hey, how do you kind of balance? We're fighting for seeding. We want to win this game versus we may just see y'all in a couple of weeks. So we don't really want to put everything on the table, especially since this is the first time that you're seeing this version of the team. And so for Atlanta, like, are we going to see Onyeka Okongwu on Josh Hart once this series actually starts? And we tap into that bag. And that's going to tie you right back into what kind of counters do the Knicks have to make sure you can get to Brunson Cat actions and get two on the ball. Just in general, can we get Cat fruitful touches and fruitful areas of the floor? But it once again starts with Karl-Anthony Towns for me on the New York side at the very least.
I'll try and go as quick as I can because we have talked Hawks Knicks. We just talked about it. If you have a computer, go to YouTube, go to the Yahoo Sports NBA channel. You can talk about our live reaction. But I think it is a very impactful point to see how intentional the Knicks want to be offensively. Will the Hawks put a center or a five on Cat? And what does that do for the Knicks? If you're talking about the Karl-Anthony Towns, Jalen Brunson two-man game, a lot of that comes from, and when it's most unlocked, that comes from a center being on Cat. Because Cat, to his credit, as good as he is, when he is guarded by centers, it's tough. He can pick and pop. He can pick and roll. It opens things up for New York to a different degree. Jalen Brunson can play pass and catch action. It's dictated by having that five. And I think the most important thing in the Knicks-Hawks matchup was the fact that they were able to poke at, not only are you having a five on Karl-Anthony Towns, we are going to make you feel uncomfortable about whatever coverage you want. You're in drop? Cool. Two on the ball? Cool. Eventually you switch? Cool. That's where that becomes a problem for Atlanta. And so can they be in a position to where we can take Cat away when we have a five on the floor and we can mix in a small lineup if we want to? If you're the Knicks, okay, if there's a big on Cat, can we open this up? Because now we have different options. And so if we are able to get Bridges and Anunoby going early as far as just being in a rhythm, if we are able to kind of have Cat be in pick and roll, pick and pop, and punish centers, and now if we don't have a first action, we can have Cat flash to the elbow and play out of that, that becomes a different Knicks team. I think the difference is playoff game plan. So if you're the Hawks, do we want to give them that? Do we pivot? And you have to deal with the Atlanta Hawks. I think that's the biggest thing I would say in the quick amount of time I'm trying to go. The Hawks are not the Pacers, but they have drawn inspiration as far as, you know what, our defense is this, but we could scale up if we're locked in on certain things. And we're going to keep scoring. And if we're not scoring, we're going to keep trying to score. And if we're not scoring when we try to score, we're going to keep doing that. So, like, they're never going to stop. So if you stop scoring, we're in transition. We're going. And now all of a sudden, what felt like a game in your favor, a 10-point lead, is now a 2-point Atlanta Hawks lead very quickly, because we have CJ McCollum, we have Nikhil Alexander-Walker, we have Jalen Johnson. We are a crew of people putting pressure on you. There's not one thing that you are looking at us and trying to take away, right? You're not trapping CJ, who, by the way, it's still insane to me that CJ McCollum has been this level of bucket getter and just teams have never just said two on the ball. Like, I know they've done it in moments, but it's like, they, sure, CJ. He's like, fine, Mark, I'll take like the space. So are you ready to execute offensively to set your defense up to deal with the Hawks? Or are you going to have a back-and-forth tennis match where you're not scoring and now they're getting themselves back in the game? And because of their ability to have pace, tempo, and self-creation, you're not having a good time because you don't know exactly who's going to get it.
No, I think that's fair. I'd say quickly on the Brunson Cat point, they've had 9 games this year in which we've gotten 15 or more Brunson Cat pick and rolls. 3 of those have come in the last like week and a half. So that is certainly perking up. And naturally, the matchup against the Atlanta Hawks on the 6th was one of those. Over 1.3 points per possession on trips featuring a Brunson Cat pick and roll in that April 6th matchup. And again, it wasn't just pick and roll. Like, there was a lot of pass and cut. On top of that, just general handoff stuff. So if they can unlock that, the Hawks may not have as much fun, but I'm curious about the cross matching of it all. As I flip to the Hawks side of this, though, because you talked about their offensive flow and just overall, they are a relentless group. We're going to keep trying to attack. And if we force misses, we're definitely getting downhill in transition. This is a spotlight series for me when it comes to Jalen Johnson. Like, hey, hello, welcome to this being your team. And now teams have to game plan against you. This is where, again, some of the cross-matching caught my eye from the New York Knicks, to where OG Anunoby, you were on Onyeka Okongwu, and we're going to try to muck things up. There's a lot of Josh Hart against Jalen Johnson. But in general, like, you are going to see multiple defenders. You are going to see crowds. Jalen Johnson against the Hawks, I mean, Jalen Johnson against the Knicks this year, 45% on twos as one of the best drivers in basketball. Like, that is not a figure that is going to get it done for the Hawks unless you are getting insane shot-making elsewhere. Now, if you ask Nikhil Alexander-Walker to have an insane shot-making stretch, he may just do that. So I certainly can't rule it out. And he's been very good against the Knicks this year and just very good overall. But I am curious to see what Jalen Johnson looks like in the half court in this series. Can he and can the Hawks generate situations or generate an environment in which he can get some easier looks? Because the transition stuff is going to speak for himself. As a finisher, as a playmaker, that part is going to be easy. When they're in the half court, if the Knicks stick with this cross-matching, are his screens going to be switches? When he initiates pick and rolls, are those going to be switches? And after that, what kind of help is he going to see? Is he able to generate clean looks for himself? Something that I've been talking about off and on this year with Jalen Johnson has been the growth for him as like a mid-range shot maker, but it's still sub-elite right now. If that just becomes his diet, that makes the Hawks a little less dangerous in the half court, and that has been kind of their bugaboo if you're projecting their playoff latitude. So I got my eyes on Jalen Johnson in this one.
Well, I mean, I think for me, I would just keep an eye on the intentionality from the Hawks. I'm top of the Knicks, but Atlanta, in that last game they played, were willing to try and poke at Jalen Brunson. And so the Knicks have operated down the stretch, and we're willing to give the Jalen Brunson switch. If at worst case we have to switch and double, that's fine, but we'll give this switch and see what happens. Can they poke at Jalen Brunson matchup hunting? Can they poke at Jalen Brunson and Cat in pick and roll together? I think the benefit of this Hawks roster is, you know, post-trade, we don't necessarily need you, Jalen Johnson, to make every single play for us. You just keep doing what you're doing. The opposite of that is when you come playoff time, okay, does a team feel comfortable that they can take Jalen Johnson away? Not that he has the talent, but because of the ensemble nature and maybe not hammering home Jalen Johnson against X at times, do we feel good that we can take him off the board and make it tough and now do something else? Let's let CJ and Nah operate. But that's the tough part about the Hawks. Those two kind of do, and then you're in the same position that you were in. So I think it's there's a amount of attention you should give Jalen Johnson. The pressure is interesting because I don't know if you're sitting at the table and saying we are doing X against Jalen Johnson? Like, are we putting two on the ball, or are we just trying to manage what he does? Like, that's the concept that gets interesting.
No, I think that's fair. And, like, I think that's where, to your point, the Hawks do not need Jalen Johnson to be 17, 18 LeBron and dictate everything. And you already too. But I do think in a playoff setting, he may be your best avenue to consistently getting two on the ball if he establishes himself early on. And so that's where I'm curious to see what that part looks like. Again, 45% on twos, like, that signals to me, like, not enough mid-range shot making, not enough of the drives and finishing in the half court specifically to where you are dictating, okay, we have to send extras. And that takes pressure off of CJ and Naw and everybody else. So fascinated by that part of the program. Quickly to that April 6th matchup, we saw that cross-matching. An 89 offensive rating in the half court for the Hawks in that game. Now, CJ missed a lot of shots, a lot of makeable shots for him. The 70-foot heave that went in did not count, so that doesn't help on that front. That would have been a half-court possession anyway. But that's where I'm just keeping an eye on. Like, hey, this half-court offense for the Hawks is going to be interesting. The other note that I wanted to hit on the Knicks front, one of the best parts of this Atlanta Hawks run in 2026 has been, not only are we cleaning the glass a little bit better on the other end and we're getting into our transition stuff, we're also generating a bunch of extra opportunities at 33 offensive rebound rate for the Atlanta Hawks against the Knicks during their regular season matchups. Like, I think the eighth highest mark of any opponent there. The Knicks don't want to force stops against this Hawks group and then give up extra possessions. So keeping an eye on that front. But yeah, Steve, who do you have?
Yeah. I have Knicks in six. Death taxes. Nakai is talking about the possession battle. It's fine. If you were asking me for my X factor, Deuce McBride for the Knicks is going to be my X factor. Okay. And for the Hawks, it's going to be... I'm going to go paint outside the lines, Corey Kispert.
Corey Kispert. Do you think he's going to have a summer?
If he's able to make shots and he's able to defend, does that not give the Hawks a level of versatility as far as who they can play when they want to play? Throwing it out there.
Okay. I hear you. It was funny to kind of track, like, who the Hawks were playing or who's getting those second unit minutes as the season ended. Like, hey, here's Richey. We don't have Richey anymore. Here's Corey Kispert. We don't have Corey Kispert. So the second unit in general is interesting for me with the Atlanta Hawks. As far as X factors go, Josh Hart for me, will you make enough shots? If they do get into the cross-matching bit, like, how quickly are you making decisions as a handoff hub, et cetera? And he's going to get the Jalen Johnson assignment, I would imagine, at least to start, if the Knicks want to stick with OG Anunoby on Onyeka Okongwu. So two-way situation there. And Onyeka is my X factor. When we did our East conversation last week, I asked you, like, hey, he's not their best player. Is he their most important guy, both for what he can do on both ends, but also who they may not have behind him or what the options are behind him if he doesn't play well or if he's in foul trouble or anything like that? Jock Landale doesn't look like he's going to be ready for the start of this series with the ankle injury at the very least. So we'll see. But that's where I'm at there. But you went Knicks in six. I really want to believe in this Hawks group. I feel like they left.
You quite literally went on TV and said the Hawks would win that playoff series. I just want the world to know that. Like, you, and this is this, where I'm in a boomerang because I remember everything Nakai says. And he doesn't. And so I'm sitting here like, you literally told me the Hawks would win the playoff series. So how are you going to get on this podcast and say the Knicks win? That doesn't make any sense.
No, this is true. And, like, I think what I was about to get into is that I think they were holding back some cards in that April 6th matchup. Like, I think there's just a level of cross-matching they could tap into that they just did not. And I do think if they do get into – if they're able to be a little bit quicker with the mismatch hunting, as you mentioned, Jalen Brunson put in action a lot, those possessions were a little bit slower than you would like late in games. They have some avenues. I'm going to go Hawks at seven. All right. Well, that concludes the East playoff series that we know. We're going to tap back in later in the week with the play-in matchup. Some fascinating ones. We'll see what happens in Sixers Magic. We'll see what happens with Heat Hornets later on tonight. Excited to break down what happens with those play-in matchups in the other series that are going to be confirmed over the next couple of days. We're going to take a break here. When we return, we shift to the W side. Fascinating WNBA draft. Fascinating free agency period so far. So we'll talk about some of the major moves that have happened over the last few days. Please stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. As we shift to the W, this has been a wild few days, Steve. one might say. Like, we had the negotiating period start last Wednesday. You could officially sign contracts on Saturday. The draft was on Monday. And so these teams are starting to get filled out. We're going to be talking quite a bit about what this offseason has been over the next two episodes. But as the draft was just last night, want to react to some of the top news nuggets from last night's action. Let's start with the top five, Steve. AZ Fudd to the Dallas Wings. Olivia Miles to the Minnesota Lynx. Awa Pham to the Seattle Storm. Lauren Betts to the Washington Mystics. Gabriela Jaquez to the Chicago Sky. I think it's fair to start with AZ Fudd at one. I don't know if I want to do like a general, how did you feel about the pick type beat? Like, were you surprised? I guess just in general, how have you soaked in the AZ at one experience?
I mean, I think for me, when I saw the Dallas Wings spent a lot of money on their big room by knocking on Minnesota's door and saying, hey, really cool that you have Alana Smith and Jessica Shepherd, we'll take them, kind of took some bigs off the table for me. And so for me, with the AZ Fudd fit, when I think about how it works for Dallas, I think AZ Fudd has a lot of potential as far as, I think, the improvement defensively, as far as the ball pressure, the screen navigation, being active, weak side, hitting rotations, that spoke for itself. The shooting, understood that like, she can shoot the ball, and that is something that can change the game in the W, especially as things evolve. But you also have an ability to have a context where Paige Bueckers can do a whole lot and be placed in a whole lot of different places. You brought Arike Ogunbowale back, and she can do a whole lot, be on ball, and make things happen. So you are not depending on AZ Fudd to make plays. You are now allowing AZ Fudd to be in a position to be off ball, to be in movement, to be in flow, hypothetically, and grow in that area without, if you don't do X, we can't do Y. That's the intriguing part of the pick for me, to where we can tap into what we believe is the potential of AZ Fudd without the pressure of, because again, the W draft is a little bit different. Number one picks really got to hit. And if they don't hit, we can point to the Dallas Wings as an example of what happens when you don't hit on that number one pick. But
yeah,
we have a context where we believe in your upside, and we can allow you the opportunity to get better within what we're doing, because we have Paige, we have Arike, we have bigs, like, and you can help us defensively, and you can shoot the ball. So if you believe AZ Fudd has another level within her, you understand this pick. If you believe that she's just going to be a catch-and-shoot player because of what UConn did, I can understand some frustration. But for me, AZ Fudd, solid pick.
Okay. Like, I think, for me, this is a great context for AZ Fudd for all the reasons that you mentioned. If you have shot creation concerns, okay, we have Paige Bueckers and Arike Ogunbowale. We also have two bigs who are phenomenal screeners and can also be used as like high post hubs to unlock handoff stuff, backdoor cuts, all the things. For a prospect that may have some, okay, what is the upside of you on the ball? It's hard to find a better spot than this for those particular concerns that you have. And so it makes a lot of sense for AZ for multiple reasons. And something that I tweeted immediately after pick was like, she accentuates or should accentuate everything that Dallas wants to do. Like, if we want more space for Paige and Arike, she's going to provide that. If we want to unlock the playbook a little bit more, which is something that Jose Fernandez talked about in their post-draft media availability, all the pin downs and the staggers and flares that she can run off of, like, she's going to help with that. Defensively, you mentioned the on-ball, more of the on-ball stuff. Her instincts off the ball, in that she can both just be a do your job player. I need to be in early. I get back out. I funnel drive and contain it. And some of the blind side stuff that she can do and the event creation that she brings. For a Dallas defense that was not very good while being incredibly aggressive, if that part sticks, AZ should fit as part of that as well. So I think she is going to help them on both sides. My thing with AZ, and it kind of bounces off something else that you said there, is like looking at the on-ball potential, which is something else that I asked about during that media availability, is like, I don't know how high that ceiling is. For this context, it may not need to be, which is the value of having her. But if you're just isolating it, you are being drafted number one, there is generally like a level of star level equity on the ball that I want my prospects to have, or at least like there's a playmaking bit, or like there's a roll gravity bit, or something else that you really feel, okay, this is how we unlock two on the ball super consistently. And so that's where I was like, okay, I understand how you get to AZ. I can also see why Olivia Miles might have been in the mix. I can see why Awafam might have been in the mix if you're looking at the long-term partnership of Paige plus Awafam. I can see how Lauren Betts may have been in the mix. Ultimately gets to Washington, we're going to get there. But like, I can see how there's a pathway to like self-creation that you feel really good about on the high end. But even with that, I was having a conversation with someone else offline. I was like, for people that are on the low on-ball upside side of the discussion, I was like, this kind of feels like how you feel about AZ's prospect at number one is going to be similar to how you feel about Caleb McBride. It's not a one-to-one player comparison, but knockdown shooter Caleb McBride, I think, has a little bit more on-ball juice. I can get to some of these pull-up middies and have some fun. We saw that in the playoffs last year as well. But it's like, if you feel good about what Caleb McBride provides, spot-up shooting, movement shooting, some secondary playmaking, can fly around off the ball, can defend on-ball well, on certain nights, I can just drop 30. You don't know when it's going to come. Then you feel really good about AZ. If you look at Caleb McBride, it's like, well, she's never been like a pure number one option. Then that's where you're a little bit disappointed. So like, I understood both sides of the coin. Like, I probably would have swung higher upside for me, but this is a really good fit for AZ. And like, this should help what they are building and their free agency. What they got in free agency allows them to build a little bit quicker. So I'm just fascinated to see like what kind of on-ball growth we see from her. But all the off-ball stuff on both ends of the floor should just pop in Dallas. So that is kind of where I am at. As for the rest of the top five, Steve, where would you like to start? Olivia Miles at two in Minnesota feels good. Seattle being able to get Awafam, her plus Dom Malanga for the foreseeable future is a lot of fun for me. Lauren Betts and Washington, like which of the rest of the top five intrigues you most?
I mean, I think we can touch on it very quickly. I'm sure once Dallas made their selection, Cheryl Reed, the Minnesota Lynx contingent, immediately put up the phone and said, yep, Olivia Miles, that'll do for us. We'll be good. And so the Lynx being able to add the caliber player of Olivia Miles to what they've built. And I think whatever unease you have with the Lynx offseason, the good portion for them is that they know what they're trying to get to. And so, yes, may they have to hit things on the margins? Sure. But we have a formula that works, and we know what we can do. And if we can do that and get feedback, we're a different team. And now we have Olivia Miles into the future. And so I think having that level of playmaking and scoring is important. I think if you're Seattle, Awafam, if you're three and you got Awafam, you feel extremely good because – hey, you know what we did last year? We got Dom Malanga, and now we have Awafam. So we are now able to just have a level of potential and upside and versatility that you're not prepared to deal with. And so that's something where it's like, ooh, we should probably keep an eye on that duo, and we still have Ezzy. And so, yeah, you know, you put the graphic up of all the people we lost. Boy, we got some upside over here from Seattle. If you're Washington, no reason to not take Lauren Betts. And I think Lauren Betts, the biggest thing for me in watching her this season in college is the little things that she improved on. That was the biggest portion for me as far as understanding the assignment and knowing what she had to do to make her team better and also improve as a player. Hey, you know what? I actually don't want to hit everyone because I'm going to get called for an offensive foul, but I'm going to force an over. I'm going to roll. That's tough. Ceiling and hitting people, getting deep paint position, not something you can say Lauren Betts never did. And the timing that she had defensively as far as understanding when to help on drives, that's where my eyes opened. Like pick and roll, okay, drop, contain, peel, switch, that's fine. But the attention to detail to know, okay, someone got me off the bounce, I'm here to help you. That's important. So I think she just took care of a lot of little things to insinuate what she can do because you can't teach what Lauren Betts has as far as her size, her skill, her footwork, her grace. That's tough to deal with. And so Washington be able to kind of just be like, hey, it's cool we have Kiki Iriafan. We also have Lauren Betts, and we're going to figure things out in a different way. We're going to put pressure on you. The Chicago Sky
We're back
with Gabriella Jaquez. Turn some heads to some folks, but for me, I think it's a good opportunity as far as rolling the dice on what Gabriella Jaquez could do. Hands off, Gabriella. You have a player who can defend, who can drive, who can make shots, and you have a roster that is, how do I say this? Stocked and veteran leadership. And so this is a forward-moving pick where we may not have all these players again at the same time, but I can now develop what I think the upside of Gabriella is without putting all the weight on her. And so the sky become an interesting blend, sort of what they have to bring to the table. So I thought the top five was very interesting, but I thought a lot of it made sense. Keke Rice to Toronto. I'm sure the Toronto contingent had ketchup chips in their hand and said, yep, we're good.
What's going to call it? Listen, they probably saw pick four and were like, hey, let's go ahead and leave a message for Kathy. If Keke is available, then this is going to be the selection. Let's go ahead and phone this in. I think that's where we're going to be at. I just going to say, like, Olivia Miles, the pick and roll play for her, the playmaking is just incredibly fun. And so the fact that you bring back Courtney Williams, bring back Kayla McBride, like, I'm sure there are going to be some lineups in which you have all three of them on the floor together. That is going to be a lot of fun for me in particular, at least offensively. So we'll see. Oh, fam, you hit the notes. Like, what do you mean I'm coming out of this draft with our fam? And then a little bit later, you get a draft day trade where you also add Flajay Johnson into the mix. And it's like, see, a way to nail that if you are the Seattle Storm. But I am excited about what that is going to be there. Washington, like, getting Lauren Betts, I think, is a good bit. And I tweeted this, like, 40 minutes of Shakira Austin, who got a max offer sheet from the Toronto Tempo, the Mystics end up matching that deal. 40 minutes knowing that I am going to have to deal with these seals and everything from Lauren Betts if she's coming off the bench. And when she's not on the floor, is Shakira Austin facing up and just driving and putting her shoulder into your chest? And then Keke Irioffen, who also just got to the line a ton. She doesn't mind facing up and driving and hitting people and sealing people. Regardless of how good you feel like the Mystics are going to be, you can look at what they did last year. They were easily one of the most annoying teams in basketball to play against when they were fully healthy. Like, pre-All-Star break, it is, here's more Keke. Here's Shakira. Brittany Sykes is driving again. Oh, my God. Sonya Citron is chasing me all over the place, and now she's driving. And now you're adding Lauren Betts into it. Like, that's just mean and physical, and I am a fan of the identity that Washington is leaning further into with their front court. Now, zooming all the way out, this is a lot of front court talent being added for Washington. And, like, it's one of those things where this is similar to what I said about... Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, Washington said, hey, are you tall? Come on down to the block.
I'm telling... Like, this reminds me of... It was either season one or season two of the Dunker Spot, Steve, where we were talking about the NBA draft at that point, and the Houston Rockets drafted, like, four or five people. And I was like, you know, I like all of these picks individually. Putting them together as a draft class, I'm just like, what is the pathway for multiple of these guys hitting? And, like, I kind of have similar feelings with Washington right now, where, like, I like Betts, I like the Cody McMahon flyer, and you kind of zoom out, like, okay, I like all this. If they're all in the same front court room with Shakira Austin there, with Keke Irioffen there, how are we building this out exactly is kind of where I'm at. So, like, I'm just gonna, you know, training camp is literally this weekend kicking off. And we're going to get preseason tape and regular season games. So we're going to see, like, what actually happens. But that's where I was like, this is a lot from Washington. We'll see. With Gabriella Jaquez, I think it's easy to see, and I think both Tyler and Jeff alluded to this in their post-draft media availability, that, like, this wasn't just, ooh, she had a really good tournament, let's get her in the building. Like, this is someone that they have identified as, like, a culture and on-court fit for us on both ends. And so, like, would I have liked either a trade back or, like, a higher upside swing from the outside looking in? Like, I personally would have, but also I am not in that room. And as I say on this podcast all the time, like, I am not the draft Nick here. So, like, there are just blind spots that I just may have. But
we're gonna get you some value out of your ESPN Plus. No, I'm just kidding.
That is crazy. Oh, y'all gonna be annoyed when I start doing threads. It's gonna be a nasty time. But if you talk about the on-ball and off-ball defense for her, which I think the off-ball defense pops a little bit more for me than the on-ball stuff, I wouldn't put the expectations of you are perimeter stopper more than you are perimeter helper for Gabriella Jaquez. But what she does off the ball defensively, what she does off the ball offensively, especially if you are anticipating Chicago, who still has Camilla Cardoso there, who's a good passer in position, Azaree Stevens, who you add, who's a very good passer in her position. If there's going to be a level of inversion with Chicago's offense, Gabriella Jaquez should slot right into that. I think she's going to be a willing screener. If you just want to get into cross, you want to get into cross screens to get those bigs deeper catches. If it is just her kind of curling golf, if it's Chicago action, ironically enough, like she's going to be able to pry Skylar free or whoever else is in that backcourt room. Like, it just makes sense. Like, I think she is a good basketball player. Now, she is someone, as you mentioned, someone that can knock down shots. I think we have like one season, at least on the college front, on file where she shot with volume and hit at a high percentage. So I would like to see that sustained. But like, if it does, she is going to be very good as a play finisher and someone that maintains advantages that are created by others. Defensively, she's going to get after it. And I think you zoom out with Chicago's offseason overall, it's a lot of dogs in the room, Steve. This is a lot of, I will get into your jersey. I will get into your chest. I will bark at you. You ain't about to have fun playing us either. And so we talk to the culture fit of it and who they want to be from a competitive standpoint. She's a very easy person to see sliding in on that front as well. So it's just been a really fascinating offseason overall for Chicago. You know, the Rekia Jackson, Ariel Atkins sign and trade is now official. You trade a 2028 first round pick for J.C. Sheldon, which I'm not giving up a first round pick for J.C. Sheldon. But when you look at the on-court fit there.
Why? No. I'm not letting you get off this. What? I know you got another pod to record after this. But here's the thing, right? I made a pick to get seven that hurt me. And I have a roster that has the 3, 4, and 5 pick in that 2024 W draft. It's not how that's supposed to work. But continue.
Like, one, it's not, but also in order to slide up to 7, you essentially gave up Olivia Miles. So like that also isn't like great in hindsight. But either way, to answer your question, like, I don't think JC has showcased like first round pick value yet. Like, a lot of that is just moving around / injuries. But in terms of what she can actually do on the floor and how she slots in with what Chicago wants to do, it's similar bids, right? I can knock down shots. Willing cutter, willing screener, can play make against a tilted defense. Defensively, I can take on tougher on-ball assignments and, again, add to the overall compete level there. So I think it is a very good on-court fit for Chicago. For me, it's just like, could we not – well, I guess you gave up the second-round pick swap in the Angel Reese trade and some other seconds in previous deals. But I'm just like, I would rather give up a second in something versus giving out a far out first round pick for JC based on what she's shown so far.
Here's what I'm going to say before we speed run through what these teams have done. I would say very quickly, you have to realize the W is a little different as far as how teams value different things. How many teams have truly built through the draft? I'm not counting the Las Vegas Aces because you had 3 number one picks. That doesn't count. No. I'm talking about the way that people are talking about draft capital. Not I hit the lottery 3 times. That's different. It's a different league. And so if you go on any sort of website and look at the draft history, there are a lot of players that got picked in positions, and are they still there? What happened? How'd they get picked this high? You will ask those questions to yourself. It's just a different time. It's a different vibe. And so I'm intrigued to see how teams value the draft going forward with having more cap space, with having more space. I also think there's an interesting inflection point this year, and it was brought up on Twitter. How important is continuity going into this year? Like, we talked about last week, how teams have leverage or they have options, players have options, but does continuity now take a team over the top? And so do we now believe if we have and know what we have in our back pocket and you guys are trying to figure it out, does that give us an advantage to where if I'm the Las Vegas Aces, yeah, you might not be impressed by what we've done, but we know who we are, and we are going to bring that to the table. You're trying to figure out who you are. If I'm the New York Liberty, I've now added a piece to what we do. We have to, you have to deal with that. If I'm Mr. Lynx, maybe you don't feel good about all of our free agency moves, but we have an established base that we're working upon. And so all of y'all are trying to pick up to this. If you're the Phoenix Mercury, maybe you don't feel great about all the signings that have gone forward so far, but they have established what they want to do. So it's the fever. As far as we have Caitlin Clark, Ravely of Boston, we're bringing a lot of people back. How much is continuity going to be important in this season at the start to where we are aware of our base and we are moving forward versus the teams that are trying to build something to catch up to us? That feels like an interesting inflection point for me.
No, I think that part is fair. And I think the appetite for like the 4 or 5 year build, I think to bounce off what you said a little bit earlier, like I don't think teams can really comfortably do that. Like it would not surprise me if we get to next year and it's like, oh, well, the Connecticut or then the Houston Comets, oh, they're spending a lot of money this offseason as they kind of build through the draft these next couple of years. And even they, like Brittany Griner, 1 year max, come on through, that kind of thing. So like I understand, like we're not about to have the 4 or 5 year thing. But I think zooming out, you do still want to have a level of optionality. So like, I think my major thing is just kind of like, if you're selling furniture or something like that, like maybe not give up your entire living room suit if you only need to sell like a couch or something like that. Whatever the analogy is there, it's just like get the piece that you want, but you don't want to oversell. Like it's a similar conversation that we had when the Nelissa Smith trade happened last year. I was like, I understand why the Aces feel like she's going to slide in, and I'm not mad at the acquisition itself. It's more, could you have gotten her for a second or 2 seconds versus giving up the future first? Like, that's my only real point of contention. Again, J.C. Sheldon, I think, is going to fit in very well in Chicago. It's just like, we want to make sure we have as much optionality access-wide as possible. That was it.
I'm gonna let you get that Nelissa take off, and we'll revisit that at a different time. Let's speed run what these teams have done, because W Free Agency has moved quickly. And would you like to talk about the New York Liberty saying, boy, Ima Misiman, that was great. Welcome, Satu Sabaly. Rebecca yeah, Allen, I'm so glad you did that podcast. Welcome back. And so, hey, tripling down on the formula of let's get size, let's get length, let's get versatility. You safe space, right? You should not have Stewie, Jonquel Jones, and Satu Sabaly on the same roster. That's not how that's supposed to work. And so it's like, well, we love Sabrina. Can we get as many big people, tall people around her to make this work? And they have multiple of those lineups. How do you feel about what the Liberty have done? We have come a long way, huh, bud?
Oh, I feel fantastic about what the New York Liberty have done. Like, this is my kind of build. Let's get playmaker and a whole bunch of skilled size. Because what do you mean I can enter this season with Sabrina Ionescu, Leonie Fevish, 6'4", can shoot leather off the ball, all defense candidate. Satu Sabaly, 6'3", 6'4", can do a little bit of everything. Breanna Stewart, who can quite literally do a little bit of everything. We'll see what happens with the three-point shooter. And Jonquel Jones, who you're just not going to have fun against in any capacity. Like, yeah, I feel pretty good about what the New York Liberty have done. If I'm the rest of the league, I'm like, how on earth has this happened? And as we have on the graphic, Breanna Stewart, Jonquel Jones, Sabrina Ionescu are going to re-sign eventually. Those contracts have not come in yet because we have no idea what the salary is about to be like for these players. I don't know. The obvious answer is there are pay cuts being taken across the board. Like, this is not going to be 4 max contracts. It literally, in a literal sense, it cannot be. So I am curious to see, like, all right, who took 800K? Who took 750? Who took 950? I would assume these are going to be like 1 year deals so then they can kind of reconfigure things next offseason. But yeah, we're all kind of waiting. We're all refreshing the timeline of Richard Cohen to see what these salaries are about to be. But from an on-court talent ad, like that is insane to add Satu Sabaly. We talked about Satu last weekend, or last week. And it's like, okay, is this going to be Toronto? Is this going to be, you know, insert team here? And the Liberty are like, yeah, so we lost one Sovely. How about we get the other one? Seems a bit unfair. And so for me, like, I'm trying to, like, hold back a little bit because last year the Liberty got off to that start. And it's like, well, I don't know if anyone's beating them. And then they add Emma Misa, and I'm
yeah,
like, well, I definitely don't know if anyone's beating them. And then they lost in round
yeah,
one. So, like, there's always room for things to go haywire.
Yeah, don't do that again. Don't do that. You leave the Liberty in the pantry. It's fine. Shout out to the state of Oregon. The interesting part for me, if we look at free agency, the Toronto Tempo, being like, hey, we are going to have an intriguing blend of talent and playmaking and skill and craft and also bucket getters. So we will have Brittany Sykes. We will have Marina Mabry. We will also go all over the pond internationally and might make sure that we have players that fit with our skills. I think the Tempo saw what the Golden State Valkyries did and said, you know what, we can build a base as well. Portland Fire as well decided, you know what, we're going to have a level of versatility and a skill and a craft, and we're going to develop these players and try and enhance it. So it gets interesting to see how these expansion teams come into this with a vision, right? I think a lot of times you say expansion team going to be bad. Golden State was like, no, we're going to do this. We're going to have an opportunity to play and be good and do what we want to do and build a base. And so you have teams understanding the assignment and trying to build something. And, you know, maybe you don't believe in a Marina Mabry or a Bridget Carlton, but they are foundational pieces to these teams. And we've seen what Veronica Burton did for Golden State. So with a different opportunity, do these players look different? I'm intrigued by what those two teams have done. What do you think?
I'm also fascinated. I think something that you hit on in particular during the expansion draft reaction pod was that you could see very clear visions of what we are trying to be. Obviously, games have to be played to see how good they're actually going to be. But you can see, like, these are the types of players that we prioritize. This is how we want to build out this roster. And I think for both, the free agency moves make sense. Like, just a level of skill and competitiveness overall for Toronto and versatility. This is why you send the max offer sheet to Shakira Austin to see, hey, Washington, do you really want to pay this for 3 years with Shakira when y'all already have this young front court? And then now we look at the draft and they draft all these front court pieces. It's like, hey, you really want to do that? Washington was like, yes, we do, actually. But even that's a window into seeing what Toronto wants and how they want to build this thing out. Just a quick salute to Bridget Carlton, who up until the Ezzie Mabigore contract came out, like, she was just the highest paid player in W history, or had signed the most lucrative W contract in W history. So just salute to Bridget Carlton on that front.
Big Bridge.
Hey, get your dollars. I will say, like, more broadly, it has been awesome between the free agency period to the draft where AZ's the number one pick. She's getting $500K in year one. The fact that they're all just getting life-changing money this offseason, like, really does warm the heart. And so I've kind of put myself on, like, a little bit of a moratorium period and just celebrating that before getting into, all right, let's look at these team salary sheets. Let's see who's getting what percentage of cap, and then I'll
complain about that later. No,
but like,
no,
I'm very happy about
no, no, no. Stop talking about the contract value and hey, salute.
I gave the salute. I did.
This is what they fought for. No, you keep the salute. So you take your hand, you put it to your head, and you keep it there. That's what you do, and you hold it there, and that's it. Salute to them for getting the money. Here's the thing, right? I'm a speedrunner. Everyone wants to yell at the Lynx, right? They know what they got to get to. Well, because they lost a lot of their pieces, right? But I think they have an understanding of what the pieces they need, and they've added some bigs that can drive and kick and space, and that's what they need to do, and that's good. You got Caleb O'Brien back. You got Courtney Williams back. They're going to piece things together. So it doesn't feel great, but honestly, Fee has been out, so it's not awesome. It's tough. Different teams do different things. Seattle, maybe it's not our year, but boy, we get some veteran experience. We add Natisha Heidemann. We add Stephanie Dolson. We have Ezzy. We have Dom. We have Abba Fahm. We can add pieces and try and build something. I think that's an important portion. If this isn't your year, it doesn't mean you just stop doing things. We have to build something to present to players. That's the Chicago Sky theory, right? Like, everyone and yell at the sky, but boy, we got Skylar Diggins to come back. Like, we are able to knock on doors and be like, hey, this is our vision. Can you help us get there? You can't stay stagnant in the W, right? The Phoenix Mercury, everyone was worried about what they did. We have AT. You know what I mean? We have Ka. We have Dawana Bonner. We're going to hit the margins on what our formula is going to be. We're going to be good. The Las Vegas Aces. Four letters, one word. Yeet. Run it back. We won a championship. We know. I said yeet first. You don't try and semantic me.
Okay.
They bring their team back. They add Stephanie Talbot, who, hey, we need you to defend. We need you to space the floor. We need you to shoot. Within the context of what the Aces have, how many minutes is that actually going to be? And how mad are you at that? Because you're going to have guard play on the court. Jackie Young, Chelsea Gray, someone's going to be out there, right? You're going to have a big on the court. All we need to do is try hard. And so I think this is a better context for Stephanie Talbot to escalate or upgrade things than the Liberty context, where she became very important at her job very quickly. And salute to the historic returner, bringing the noise to the Las Vegas Aces. But I think it gets interesting. Like, the Indiana Fever looking at their roster and saying, we need to bring people back. We need to bring Lexi Hall back. We need to bring Sophie Cunningham back. We didn't bring Natasha Howard back, right? Well, I have an idea. How about Monique Billings? How about Myesha Hines-Allen? And so let's have some toughness and versatility on top of what we do. Like, they have to hit the margins because the Fever, you know, I'm not well-versed in the Epic provision, but Caitlin Clark, likely to get paid. Aaliyah Boston, likely to get paid. We need to find people to enhance this very quickly. So if you're having players like this with what Stephanie White wants to do and what they've done traditionally, I think it's a positive thing for them. So it's been a very interesting offseason.
It's been an interesting offseason indeed. I liked a lot of what Indiana did. I'm glad you went there. I feel like there's a lot of understandable angst around Minnesota, but like looking at who they actually signed, like Natasha Howard should just fit like a glove there. I think she's going to be fine. Nia Coffey with like consistent minutes. I have always enjoyed her as like a bench piece for Atlanta. Someone that can defend multiple positions and can knock down spot up shots. Like, I think that part's going to be fine. I went down the rabbit hole once I think we got the Kareem Copeland tweet. Where it's like Alishka Hamzova and Emma Chikova were signed. I was like, okay, well, who are these players? Let's tap in. And I was like, oh my goodness, I see why Cheryl Reeve is pleased and why she's bringing them in. They're probably going to be rotation pieces, and I feel like we're going to hit like early July, and the Lynx are going to be like 3 or 4 games over 500. And you'll be like, oh my God, Cheryl Reeve, coach of the year. Look what happens. She's like, well, they scout well and they know what they want to do. And Courtney Williams and Kayla McBride are still good at basketball, and like they are going to get feedback eventually. So like I think they're going to be fine. I'm curious about what the Mercury are going to do. But it's been a very entertaining free agency. Condensed one, but an interesting one nonetheless. I'm trying to think, is there anything else that we did not hit on that I want to make sure that we got on?
Shoot your shot.
Just well done in general for the Los Angeles Sparks. Ariel Atkins got the big bag, 3-year deal. It's part of signing a trade to get there, but you have NECA. We talked about it on the last pod. Bringing back Kelsey Plum for $999,999 is one of the funnier things I have ever seen in terms of transaction stuff. So quick salute to Kelsey Plum.
Shout out to KP. I have an shout idea. Out to KP.
Take away $1. Derek Hamby back. Ray Burrell is back. And then getting to Nia Latson in the second round of the draft. Surprised that she slid out of the first round. But her landing in L.A. in particular is something that I really enjoy. And even going back to the Fever portion, you add Monique Billings, you add Myesha Hines-Allen. Ty Harris is going to be really good as a backup point guard there, which takes a little bit of pressure off of Raven Johnson, who I really like to pick there. If you want to get some guard defense in the room, hello, Raven Johnson. Being added to that mix, that should be a lot of fun. I think the Fever did a really good job. They're going to be poised, assuming you get a healthy campaign for Caitlin Clark this year. to make some major strides this season. And they were not far off from making the finals anyway last year. So they have set themselves up pretty gosh darn well, health permitting. So we'll see how the rest of these rosters get rounded out. Like, we got a lot of big names announced, you know, Friday, Saturday, a little bit into Sunday, and now we're getting the full rush of training camp contracts. As, again, training camp is just coming up in the next few days with how condensed this offseason has been. So we'll get a firmer picture of what the full rosters are over the next couple of days. But I'm excited, Steve. I'm excited. Playoff time, play-in time, W season right around the corner. This is the best time of basketball. Most full part of basketball, but most exciting part of basketball nonetheless. And so that is going to do it for us. Thank you for watching and or listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe. Shout out, Kelsey Paul. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where a lot of our W content is going. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.